Baptist or the baptizer, yet he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has been forcefully advancing, and forceful men lay hold of it. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you're willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who was to come, or it's predicted in the Old Testament. So he who has ears, let him hear. Now we get the little parable addition to it. Now, to what can I compare this generation? They're like children sitting in the marketplaces, and they call out to others, "We played the flute for you, and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge, and you didn't mourn. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say he's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners." But, Jesus concludes this, but wisdom is proved right by her actions. Wisdom is proved right by her actions. Father in heaven, please allow us an understanding with both mind and heart to allow us, we pray, to step in to understand the flow of this discussion, this talk that Jesus is doing, and what he was addressing when he spoke that day. But at the same time, we want to know that with our minds. We also know that you have preserved these things to help men, women, and children over the generations have guidance, not only to understand what's out there, but also understand the hard thing, which is what is inside of each of us. And we ask that the Spirit of Christ might move wonderfully in us in that direction as we look at this evening. In his name we pray. Amen. I was only a year or two into the pastorate when I had it wasn't my first disturbing experience, but it was certainly one that left a very deep impression on me. It was a very subtle, quiet kind of thing. But here's what happened. I got a call one day from a woman. She was not a member of our church, but I think in a distant past it had some loose connection with it. And she said, "I'm not a member of your church, but would you be willing to do something for me?" And I asked her what it was. She said, you know, she's up in years, her husband's up in years. And she said, and he's in the hospital and things are not going well. Would you please come and visit him? And I'm always up to that kind of thing. I never know what I'm going to see when I get to the other side of things. I've had varieties of interesting experiences. This was interesting, but for a reason that I wasn't quite prepared for. I visited the man. And actually, over the months ahead, the woman was so appreciative that I was willing to take the time to do this for, you know, someone I didn't know. He didn't know me other than the visits. And so she welcomed them, and I thought, well, it's an open door, I'll take it. Here's what I found with him. He'd reached retirement age, and his health had been okay. He'd been very much into sports. He loved gardening, things like that, which is fine. But after he retired, very, very bad, health hit him. And I won't go through the whole litany of things, but there were two apparent things as I visited with him. Number one, he had had a series of strokes, which meant that he couldn't walk, he couldn't get around, he couldn't manage, and really he couldn't talk. I don't think I ever really, really understood what he was saying very much. He would talk, but it was just not possible to understand it. That was the first thing I noticed about him, and I felt really bad for that. Here was the other thing that I noticed about him that I couldn't avoid is, you know how it is in the hospital rooms, they always have a obligatory television, you know, mounted on the wall there, and person has TV, which is in and of itself is fine. He always had the TV on. In fact, he had it on very loud. In fact, he had it on loud, and it didn't matter what was going on around him. He wanted to be able to watch sports all his waking hours. That was all that mattered to him. He couldn't garden anymore, obviously. Couldn't talk. Probably didn't have much of an interest in talking. But as long as he had sports, he was happy. And I thought this was interesting. And what was the other part in all of this is over the months I was visiting, he had a series of amputations. Parts of one leg till eventually it was all gone. Other leg till eventually it was all gone. So he had the stroke. He couldn't talk. Couldn't do this. Couldn't do that. Amputations. But there was one thing that he loved, and that was sports. And that was it. And when he passed away, I did his funeral. And that was the end of that. And it wasn't that anything terribly bad happened. It was what didn't happen that was so disturbing. I wondered to myself, how can someone at the end of three quarters of a century of life be heading toward the end of it? I have no idea what he perceived of after death. I don't know. But whatever it was, it didn't matter to him so long as he had sports on television. And that really, it prompted a minor, one of those productive crises, you know, things that really disturb you, but eventually it has a good effect. Because I started to think to myself what actually began a long series of observations over years, which was this: what do people say that they really want, and what do they really want? That seems to me something real basic. What would he say he wanted? Well, he agreed with his wife. I'd like the pastor to come visit me. You know, I guess that's a good thing. But what did he really want? Well, I don't know a definitive answer. I'll just give you a tentative one. He just while away his time with sports. I'm not against sports. Please hear me out. I'm not sure against sports at all. But there are some other things in life, like eternity and your soul. And I was amazed. But as I thought about this and this disturbing paradigm that he was presenting to me, I thought of some other ironic things in life. Here's a couple, and you may have seen some of these kinds of things. I remember working some years ago for a while with a rescue mission up in upstate New York, and I ended up having extended conversations with a lot of really, really down and out alcoholics. And having come from a family that has a distinguished line of alcoholics in it, it was interesting to me to sort of see what people are thinking. And I'm just going to quote one man, but I suspect he speaks for many, at least of the people he was with. He would say this: on the one hand, he didn't like the degradation that abject drunkenness levied on him. I mean, this is a guy we would pick up from the streets regularly and bring him into a shelter so he wasn't injured. You know, that was the level of degradation he was at. In a sense, we were protecting him from himself. That was the one side. Didn't like that. That was dangerous. On the other hand, as he said to me very clearly, he said, "I love to drink. I love it from when it goes in to when it leaves my body." He says, "I love every moment on me." I thought, well, do you hate it or do you love it? Which is it? Do you hate it or do you love it? Well, of course, with addictions, that's the funny thing. You both hate and love simultaneously. That's the thing that's so disturbing. And really, when you think about it, you can take this to other areas in life. Like, take any kind of sin you want to think of. And you know yourself. You can answer this specifically for yourself. Think of anything you've ever said or done or neglected to do or say or do, and ask yourself, how did I feel about my involvement in whatever? You answer this for yourself. And the answer may be both of these things once again. I hated myself for doing, you know, fill in the blank, X, Y, and Z. I hated myself as I was doing that. But on the other hand, why was I doing that? Well, because I felt that I could somehow bag a good in that I would like. And it's this love-hate thing that, let's say, this is what it is to be human and fallen. To be human, to be sinful, is to be in a strange relationship with lots of things in life that have both a detestable and, at least on the surface, desirable aspect to them. And as I started to extend this kind of insight, and I was doing a lot of counseling with people, I like to talk with people. It goes with the territory, right? Especially couples thinking about getting married and what the future might look like for them. And it used to be that I would start a counseling session or a series of them with sort of me telling them what I think they needed to hear. That's okay. There's some place for that. But I realized what I need to start asking people is, how do things look to you? Like, what do you really, truly want? I'm not going to necessarily say what they want is the right thing, but what I'm saying is I need to start with what they value. And sometimes what I need to help people do, and I need to help myself do, is be honest. Because what we say we want and what we really, really want may or may not be the same thing. And the more you can bring those two together, what I think I want, what I really want, the closer you can bring those two together, at least at that point you're getting honest with yourself. It's not the end of the journey, but it's a major clarifying piece. So as I approach, and as we approach this passage tonight with two seemingly not connected things, you know, the friends of John who come and they're concerned to clarify that for John that Jesus is exactly the one John thought he was preparing for. Yes, he was right. That's the easy part to see. And Jesus giving phenomenal praises to John. Think about this. Imagine someone saying to you, of people born of women, which covers most of us, right? Of people born of women, no one has ever risen who's better than that. And that's an incredible praise. But that's the easy part to see. Then why does it go into this little parable of children playing in a marketplace and people are unhappy? I'd like to explore that just a couple minutes with you. So what I want to suggest to you is that Jesus is getting at this motivation thing. Now he's talking to people who had interacted with John. In other words, they'd gone out at least to hear him. Now, maybe they went out to hear him with a good attitude, maybe not, but the point is they had interacted. So he's asking, you know, you've gone to all the trouble of going out into the desert to hear this guy and interact with this guy. Why? Why'd you do it? Because remember, two people may do the same activity, but for completely different reasons. Right? Doesn't mean they necessarily have the same motivation. So what'd you go out to see? And to get at this, he brings out this difference, and I think you're probably acquainted with this, in terms of daily operations, John and Jesus were very different, right? John lives the simple life, the desert life, the ascetic life. In the locusts and wild honey thing, I get the honey part, okay? All I can say for the other part is at least it's high in protein and low in fat. That's the extent of it. I don't ever want to. I've seen locusts. I don't want to eat them. All right. I don't care how they're cooked. I don't want them. All right. But that's the life he's willing to live in order to do the particular thing that God's called him to do. How about Jesus? Well, we know from the outset, according to the Gospel of John, Jesus goes to wedding parties. He's constantly at people's house for dinner. You know, he's enjoying good food, good drink. And it's this contrast, which is the angle on getting not ultimately just to Jesus and John, that's worth something, but to get to your heart and my heart. Here's the problem. If you don't like John, it makes sense you like Jesus. Or if you like Jesus and the dinners and the food, and I'm all thumbs up with that, you don't have to like John. But what happens if someone doesn't like the one or the other? You're too strict, you're too loose. It suggests that maybe something is not right here. An observation, again, from my own point of view over many years of dealing with people, it's been interesting. Occasionally, people have gotten upset at me. Can you imagine someone getting upset at me? I can't imagine, but anyway, they do. And they get upset at me, they get upset at church. I'm leaving your church. I don't like it because you do this, 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 and this. We don't like all that. And then they go to a church that does the same stuff. I'm always kind of fascinated. I think, then probably the things we were talking about that you said were important were not really what we needed to be talking about. In other words, what you say you want and what you really want, maybe they're more apart than you realized. So there's the angle and here's the parable, okay? So you got the kids playing, and maybe you remember this in childhood. I know it was a long time ago for some of us. Certain kids play nice. Certain kids don't, right? Certain kids have creative ideas. Let's do such and such. And it's okay to say to someone, I don't want to play that game so long as you have an alternative, right? I don't want to play that game, but I'm okay with this game or this game. That's playing nice, right? If you say no on something, you've got to say yes to something else. And if you simply say no to everything, if you're simply unhappy with everything all the time, then at some point, that's just not, not the way it goes. So getting now to our motivations, what do you really want? That's the title of the message here. this is what you're starting to get in verse 12. I want to reread it. I want to tell you two translations. I actually quite like the way the NIV puts it. It's a, by the way, the Greek, I've studied the Greek many, many times over on this particular verse, and it is a hard one to translate that legitimately opens a couple questions. So I don't want you to think that one translation is always right and one is always wrong. It's nothing like that. But here's first the Numerican standard of verse 12. From the days of John until now, the kingdom of heaven, I'm going to read its Numerical standard. The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. It's not a bad translation, but it just seems odd. Violent people are taking heaven. What is that all about? Here's a variation that gets much closer to what the... I like the NIV, by the way. Here's one that gets it a bit closer. That eager men, energetic men, are vigorously seizing the kingdom with a holy violence. In other words, we don't usually think of violence as something good, but once in a while, have you ever fought for something that you knew was good and it was worth pouring your energy out for it, even though it was a level of energy you normally wouldn't, you know, exercise? I bet you have. And so here are people who, as they figure out, what do I want in life? What do I want? There'll be some who say, I don't like John, I don't like Jesus, just chuck it all. There will be some who will say, no, I see something huge and God-based here, and I want it, I'll take it. You know, I'll have it. By the way, I sometimes do this in class. I'm not going to do this here tonight, so you got to pass this up. Plus, it would have been American dollar bills anyway. I've sometimes done this in class. I'll make a point in class. I have a bunch of students around. I'll say, I'll pull a dollar bill out of my wallet, and I'll go through the class, and I'll say to people, would you like this? And I was right, would you like this dollar bill? And you know what the standard response is always, oh, no, I wouldn't want that, you know. And then finally someone will say, sure, I'll take it, and I'll give it to them, and I'll give them the dollar bill, and they're thinking I want it back. I said, no, I was offering you a dollar bill, you can have it. And then the rest of the class is thinking to themselves, oh, rats, I just passed up, you know, I could have bought a candy bar with that. And it's this idea that if you really, 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 really want something, take it, especially if it's offered to you. Take it. So here's Jesus saying, the kingdom of heaven, if you really want it, it's there for you. If you really want your Creator, He's there for you. Paul puts it this way at the Areopagus, you can grope for God and get to Him. It's a wonderful thing. It may take a bit of struggling, but if it's something you really want, it's there to be had. Okay? The question is for you to ask yourself, what do I really want? What do I really want? I was gratified a handful of years ago. I ran into a book by an author, David Powlison. I don't know if the name means anything to you. He's a biblical counselor. And David Powlison, you always like when people write your ideas, you know, you think, I had that idea first, but you know. And so I was very glad. He actually does something along these lines. In his book, Seeing with New Eyes, he talks about what he calls asking X-ray questions in counseling. He offers about 36 questions to ask people, like, what do you love? What are you afraid of? You know, what really turns on your lights? You know, what things do you love to be involved in? There's no secret agenda to it other than finding out what a person really, truly wants, what motivates them, both what do we want to have, as well as what do we want to be away from. They're all part of our wants. And as I realized, in order to know people, I have to ask these kinds of questions. I've learned that over the years. In order to know myself, same thing. I have to ask. So I can try and bring together. And these are the two questions I'd like to leave with you tonight, though I have a couple more things to say about them. Got to figure out for yourself, what do you really want in your life? I mean, if it helps you to break a little scratch list, whatever it takes, do that. Figure out what you really, what matters to you, what you value, what you think is worthwhile both. And I mean worthwhile for this life. It doesn't all have to have like an obviously eternal perspective. That's helpful in there too, of course. But I say it could be for the here now. That these are the things that I think are so worthwhile. They're so important. They're so, you know, God-driven, God-based, that I'm willing to expend my time, my energy, my imagination, my resources, anything I have, making this, as much as I can do it, making this happen. I know there's things out of our control. I get that. But the fact is, you do put your energies somewhere. Every day you put your energies somewhere. The question is, what and where? What do I really want? What do I really want? Because sometimes what we're thinking is, what does someone expect of me? Or what am I feeling pressured to, supposed to want? That can be risky. What do I really want? And it's not the end of the road, but it's a point of honesty. And that's why Jesus brings this up in this interaction on John the Baptist, with John the Baptist. We have mixed motivations. By the way, don't worry. Good people, mature people, people in all kinds of positions in life have mixed motivations. I'm going to, you know the expression, hang somebody else's dirty laundry out on the line, okay? But I'm going to do that because the Bible allows me to do this. Let's go with the apostles, okay? Were the apostles well-motivated? I have no doubt in many ways they were, okay? Jesus is working to make men do great things, so I have no doubt. But just occasionally, we get a window into the fact they had mixed motivations. Quick and clear example. In a couple places, including Mark 9, there is an argument between the apostles about who was most preeminent within the circle of apostles. If you sit back and think about that, that's both surprising and quite sobering. Here are the big guys. You know what the rest of the Bible calls the cornerstone, not the cornerstone, but the foundation stones of the church. Okay, guys, we're indebted to because they laid a foundation that we've been building on since, and they were struggling with motivations. Because some of them, maybe all of them, I don't know, but at least some of them are thinking to themselves, at least at that point, I want to look good. I want to have something that makes me look more desirable than somebody else. I want to be able to hold something over someone else. And maybe it's good that we are allowed to see their shortcomings. Otherwise, you know, most of us are always saying, boy, how come I have all these problems and everybody else seems to be so far ahead of me? Well, no, they're human, as we are. So the mixed motivation thing. Here's how the author T.S. Eliot, listen to this. T.S. Eliot once said, very brief, he said, humankind cannot bear very much reality. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. In other words, we would rather think about what we're supposed to want than be honest enough with ourselves to really plumb the depths of our soul, heart, loves, passions, and priorities. And though there's much more to be said down the road, which is not going to be said tonight, being honest with those and being forthright with those is, it's hard work to acknowledge all that we are. It's no pleasant task to look deep into your soul. You'll find some things that are beautiful. You're going to find things where you say, God, thank you so much for creating and reconstructing what you're doing. There's that there as well. But there will be those things that are yet to be. Someone has put it this way. The process of life and sanctification is like this. You've got an old house, and at the very same time, pieces of this house are being ripped apart, torn out, cut out, and the pieces are getting torn down. Simultaneously, things are being put in their place, and the house, as it's being torn down, is also being built up. And seeing those tearing down pieces is not an easy thing. So as you think about, you know, the things that motivate you and what things you hope for, here's just a couple of glimpses. Now, these are pretty big picture glimpses. They're not specific, but they're showing us that the Bible does address our motivations. It addresses our actions, of course, but our motivations. Here is Job. In the worst part of his life, you know the story of Job and the suffering and anguish he goes through, simply says, I will hope in God. Now, it hasn't provided every answer to his question. He never gets every answer to all his questions. He has a long travail to walk through, But there's one thing clear for Job. I will hope in God. Given a choice, curse God and die is the advice he's given. As he thinks about it, he goes, no, I'm not going to go that route, even though I don't know the actual outcome. I will hope in God. Here's Paul in the famous love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. Love hopes all things. Interesting. So there's a possibility in loving God and loving people that is looking for positive and upbuilding things, even if we don't know all the specifics of what they are just yet. Here's Galatians 5, Paul once again. I'm waiting, and we all are waiting, for the hope of righteousness. That means I haven't arrived at all these points yet in whatever my growth is going to be. I know it's in a process, but I've got a hope. I've got a determination. That's the direction I'm going to be going. That's a clarification of your motivations. Hope in the living God, he says in 1 Timothy 4:4. So take all these together, and I'd like to suggest this as we close here. Do examine your heart. The Bible often encourages many places, says, examine yourself. Get to know your heart. Don't be self-obsessed. I'm not trying to encourage that. But examine yourself. You know, in Romans 10, it says, we believe with our heart. What that's getting at is that there's an inclination, orientation set within us. It's very, very deep. And belief has something to do with that whole orientation in a certain way. And then clarify your priorities. And take a cue from the apostles at their not-so-good time of jostling for power. And ask yourself sometimes, is it possible that I might have even been looking for a good thing, but not for the right reasons? You open to that as a possibility. And engender honesty within yourself and before God. I want to suggest to you, and I've said this periodically to people, I say, whatever ugly things you have to say them to God. If you have doubtful things to say them to God. If you're angry about stuff, say it to God, because he's big enough, he won't be shaken by you. Many people think I've got to be super polite when I go to God. I'm not saying politeness is a bad thing. You know, I'm just saying honesty would be even better. Honesty and genuineness, far better. And we can pray together, God, bring us into the light. And with clear light, we see things as they really are. And one of the things we need to see is ourselves and our own souls when we're before him. Father, may you help us in that. It's no easy task. We truly admit that with Elliot that we at times... the last thing we want is reality. We would like to imagine certain things to be better than they are. We don't want to ignore all of the reconstruction that has been rebuilt in us. We don't want to forget that you've been doing a wonderful thing, that you made us in your image, and you're making us more and more in your image as you build us in Jesus. But at the same time, we see those good things. We know that we have to be straightforward with ourselves, and especially in front of you. Help us to do that sometimes impossible task so that we could confess honestly, embrace honestly, and know what we really want. And as that wanting and yearning is purified, that might be a good and a holy desire to seize heaven with an energetic violence and live life as we ought. In Jesus we pray that.